I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Last week, a Pennsylvania grand jury released its report on the sexual abuse of children by Catholic clergy in the state. The findings? More than 300 priests exploited 1,000 children over seven decades. As shockwaves rolled over the country at the news, victims in Kansas and Missouri demanded similar investigations in their states. Today, we'll ask how area Catholics are responding to these latest developments within their church. Later, we see examples every day of people so deeply entrenched in their own point of view that talking with them seems impossible. But there's hope and a way for talking across the divide and maybe even changing minds. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. The Catholic Church once again is in an uproar over sexual abuse committed by its priests following shocking disclosures from Pennsylvania just the other day. A grand jury report found that more than 300 priests had exploited 1,000 children going back over seven decades. Now a growing chorus is rising in Kansas and Missouri about the need for a grand jury-style investigation into clergy sexual abuse crimes similar to what took place in Pennsylvania. The Kansas City Star editorial board today called for the attorneys general in Kansas and Missouri to launch full-scale investigations. With us to talk about where the church goes from here, Dennis Cody is editor of the National Catholic Reporter based here in Kansas City. Dennis, welcome.
Thank you, Steve.
Kerry Cooper is director of the Kansas City St. Joseph Diocese Office of Child and Youth Protection. Kerry, nice to have you.
Thank you.
Annette Hodges is here. She's the Kansas City representative of SNAP, or Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests. Annette, good morning.
Hi.
In the wake of the news out of Pennsylvania, we're interested in getting reactions from the local Catholic community to this issue in Kansas City. What do you want to see happen next? Does the investigation into abuse of clergy need to continue? If so, who should lead it? Lay people? The Attorney General? Our number, 816-235-2888. Again, 816-235-2888. Or you can tweet us at KCURUpToDate. Well, Dennis Cody, again, from the National Catholic Reporter, what has been the reaction, as best as you can gauge it, to the news out of Pennsylvania, at least from Kansas City area Catholics here?
I think what we're picking up on is a lot of, dismay, despair. There's some anguish. Catholics are questioning what's going on and how to go forward with these issues.
Kerry, how about you?
Sadness would be the first thing that comes to mind. Sadness for the harm that has been done to so many people and their families.
Yeah.
And disappointment in the cover-up.
Mm-hmm. You know, Annette Hodges, again, from SNAP, what are you picking up from your community over in Sedalia, I think? Yeah.
Our phones have rung a lot more the past week with other people coming forward and telling about their abuse, as well as people who have come forward already. They are having to relive this over and over again.
Mm-hmm. Has church attendance been affected, Dennis? Have you picked up anything on that side of the equation?
No, I don't think so. Again, what we've seen in the past is this comes in waves, and our newspaper has been covering this issue since the mid-1980s.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it comes in waves. There are some people who will stay away, but gradually they'll come back. There's no long-term effect in this that can be measured with sociological surveys and things like that. But there's there's an enduring unwillingness, and there's a breakdown of trust that has been eroded over time, and that's probably what we see more than anything else.
You can't help but wonder how many punches can an institution take. Dennis, I mean, you just begin to wonder.
Yeah, the grand jury report out of Pennsylvania is kind of the second punch that we've experienced in the Catholic community this summer. Through May, June, and July, we saw revelations about a Cardinal McCarrick, who was the Archbishop of Washington, D.C., who found allegations, credible allegations of sex abuse against minors on him that forced his resignation, eventually his resignation from the College of Cardinals. At the same time, what came out were revelations that he had had sexual relationships with adult men and seminarians as he was rising through the ranks of the hierarchy. And so that, coupled with the grand jury report out of Pennsylvania, just like I said, it was a 1-2 punch, and it left a lot of Catholics kind of staggering.
Kerry, you're with a diocese here. Do you wonder how many punches that one institution can take, like your church?
I do. It's really a hard time right now for Catholics. But I do. I know that so many people care about the Catholic community locally and even farther than that. There's a great deal of care for the people that have been harmed and a desire to right those wrongs. I see a desire for the reform that has been talked about. Pope Francis talked about reform. Cardinal DiNardo promised reform. So that is something that I do see that there's hope now, that so much has been brought up, as Dennis outlined, that it's time now to really address that.
I mean, we've been saying that for a while now, and somehow the cavalry doesn't seem to be arriving in the way that a lot of Roman Catholics think it needs to be arriving here. What about that?
The church moves slowly. That is true, and I don't know that it's
a crisis with immediate proportions attached to it.
Right. I think we'd all like to see it be a quicker response, mm-hmm. A quicker reform.
Mm-hmm.
And so now it's time for the leaders to step up and to show us that there can be reform. In the meantime, I think in our communities, I think it's so important for people that have been abused to come forward, to speak up, to let their diocese know what has happened to them so that the diocese can ensure that perpetrator is no longer in ministry,
mm-hmm.
and offer care to that person and their family.
Yeah. Annette, the pace of reform, what kind of response do you have to that?
We need complete transparency. And as we've known for 30 years, the church has hidden this and continues to hide it. And the only way we feel that we'll have complete transparency is if we have a grand jury convened, like was in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm.
You know, have we actually gotten to the point where parents are saying they won't take their kids to church anymore, Dennis, because they're afraid of what might happen to them? Is that happening out there now?
You know, again, from my perspective, I think for the first time in a long time, I don't think in the Catholic Church across the board, that's not a major concern. I think for the first time in a long time, children are safer in the church than they have been a very long time. Offices like Kerry's have done an excellent job of putting in place procedures, training personnel to spot grooming behaviors and abusive behaviors, background checks on employees and volunteers. And for the most part, there are exceptions across the country in this, but for the most part, the Catholic Church is one of the safest places for children to be. I have to agree with that.
Annette, do you see it that way?
No, I don't.
Because?
Just reading the Pennsylvania report, we have seen how they continued to cover it up even after the Boston spotlight,
mm-hmm.
which is just amazing.
That was the scandal in Boston in the early part of the century that the
yes.
Boston Globe uncovered.
In 2002.
Yeah, right. Okay, lots of phone calls here as we talk about the Catholic Church and its response to this crisis of sexual abuse involving its priests. Again, the question on the table, what do you want to see happen next year? Does the investigation into abusive clergy need to continue? And if so, how? 816-235-2888 is our number. Rob from Overland Park, good morning.
Hey, Steve. Good morning. I totally agree with the lady from SNAP. It needs to be totally transparency. I married a Catholic. She was raised, went to Catholic schools, and this issue about the pedophiles in the Catholic Church and even in the Kansas diocese just led her right out of the church. And now we both belong to a different, loving, opening, transparent church, which is not Catholic. And I don't know why people continue to go to church unless they're so indoctrinated into the Catholic belief system that they just can't get it out of their system. She had a hard time. I had a hard time getting out of the church system that I was indoctrinated into, which did not happen to be Catholic, but the same sort of thing. We both came from same religious upbringings that were dysfunctional.
I was going to say, how hard was it for your wife, we're talking about the Catholic Church here, to make the transition you're talking about, Rob?
Very difficult. She was going to Mass as well as to this new church that we found. She couldn't cut the cord. I stopped talking about it because I thought, I don't know why she's still going. But when she finally made up her own mind, she said, I'm done. And it probably took 3 to 4 years for her to totally cut the cord with her Catholic belief. It took me probably 10 to 15 years to cut the cord with my original religion that I was indoctrinated in. And I use that term because I really believe that that's what some religions, not all religions, because we're in a wonderful church now.
Okay. Rob, I appreciate the phone call. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good luck. Bye. You bet. Let's go to Robert from Kansas City, Missouri. Robert, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I want to just sort of steer this whole conversation in another direction. Granted, there's the Catholic Church. There's the one, there's some definitely at fault. But where is the law enforcement in all this? Some of these crimes are reported for sure, and nothing happened. Hmm. It's almost like the law enforcement also needs to be sued or be held accountable. I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Robert, thank you for the comments. And where is the law enforcement in all this? Dennis, what are you seeing?
In the Philadelphia or the Pennsylvania grand jury report, they did interview one of the former local district attorneys, and he admitted that he, on the advice of the local bishop, he let a case slide. And, you know, and he regrets that to this day. But that's in the report. So there is some of that. There was some of that in that report.
Are we seeing a response from law enforcement here in our neck of the woods that you would deem as satisfactory?
Again,
it's hard to evaluate.
It's hard for me to evaluate.
I can speak
carry
to that.
The police.
Yeah, please go ahead, Annie, Carrie.
So part of the reason my office was formed was out of the scandal with Sean Rattigan that was back in 2011. And one of my goals in forming this office was that to have that cooperation with law enforcement, to have that working relationship between the church and law enforcement so that we can ensure that these things are, any crime is reviewed thoroughly and that person punished to the full extent of the law.
So law enforcement knows now that it can come to this diocese in Kansas City and get full cooperation for whatever it needs.
Yes, and we adopted a model. Before I was hired, the diocese hired an ombudsman. Mm-hmm. Our ombudsman, Jennifer Valenti, has a background in law enforcement. So this model has independent people that receive reports. There are still dioceses across the United States where a clergy person, maybe it's a priest, will receive a report of abuse. And so then there's a lack of transparency there, wondering, you know, what is the process of that getting to law enforcement?
Again, you almost can't help but wonder, why hasn't that changed across the board, again, given the gravity of what the church is up against right now?
So I would advocate that is a reform that I'd like to see, this model would be expanded to where other dioceses. I know some have already adopted this model, but I think it could be a welcome reform to include lay people, people with expertise in law enforcement, expertise in sexual abuse and the crimes involving it.
Again, Annette Hodges with SNAP, how comfortable are you, how satisfied are you with this this level of cooperation that we're hearing about between the local diocese and law enforcement?
I can tell you in 2008, after the settlement, I spoke to many of the survivor and the victims. And they were very happy about the non-monetary agreements. And then the church in 2011 hid the Sean Rattigan, which was devastating to the victim, to the survivors. So they don't have much trust. And at the same time, we continue to see the church have lobbyists to fight against the statute of limitations for these crimes. Mm-hmm. That needs to stop. It's a crime against a child. I don't care if that child is 62 years old now. They killed and murdered the person that child was supposed to be.
There is lobbying going on where in Topeka and Jefferson City to do what you're talking about?
For the statute of limitations, they, just like in Pennsylvania, most of the cases that were reported before the grand jury are too old to prosecute.
Mm-hmm.
So these people basically got away with it. And that needs to stop.
And you're saying the church here locally is still
yes.
lobbying for what? To ensure that those statutes of limitation aren't extended?
Exactly. Yes.
Okay. And that's going on now.
Yes.
Yeah. Do you know much about that, Carrie?
I'm not involved in that, so I don't know much about that ever.
Yeah.
I'm
okay.
Sorry.
816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Let's go back to some calls. And James from Independence. James, good morning.
Yes, good morning, Steve. To the gentleman who's on the show with you who says that the Catholic Church is a good, safe place for children to be in, I think is an insult to the community to promote the Catholic Church under these circumstances when there are thousands, and that's just the ones that are reported, thousands of abuses that have gone on. Secondly,
I think, James, just in fairness to Dennis, he's saying that the church today is in a better place than it's been in recent years.
Yes. Yeah. And the second just let me say one thing and then I'll listen to what you're saying. But the second part of what I wanted to say with that, though, is that has only happened because of extreme diligence from groups like Annette's SNAP group, from media pressure and from grand jury reports and other legal actions, criminal actions that have forced dioceses to adopt these rules and regulations. I'm not saying it's perfect. I'm just saying it's better.
James, go ahead, and you have a chance to keep going here.
Okay, that's good that it's better. But then the idea that the church would be a part of investigating itself. Now, corporations commit crimes, and they want to do the investigation of themselves. They're not likely to be up and open about what's really going on. So I think it is probably best that the law enforcement agencies and legal avenues are taken. But I just heard that some of the dioceses are trying to stop the idea that we can extend the statute of limitations.
Right.
That is very ominous. And that they are wanting this to just go away without anyone having to be held responsible
right.
for these atrocities.
Yeah, James, I appreciate your comments. I've got to move on. Carrie, is the diocese here locally investigating itself right now? Is there an investigation that might even precede anything that the attorneys general in our two states might do or that local prosecutors might do?
Is there an investigation currently in the diocese
of itself?
The
diocese is investigating itself somehow.
So our process is first to contact civil authorities. So when we receive a report, it's shared with civil authorities first.
Mm-hmm.
And once their investigation is complete, then our investigation begins.
Is there any, but in before that happens, even without a complaint, is there any sort of internal machinery spinning right now for the church to take a hard look at itself and where it's been in recent years?
We certainly are taking the time right now to look at our efforts. We certainly have come a long way in the 7 years since this office began, and there's always room to improve. So we do have a renewed sense of wanting to take the time to review where we are and what we've done and where we are currently
okay.
so that we can improve.
Let me go back to some calls and Jim from Olathe. Jim, you're on Up to Date. We're talking about the Roman Catholic Church and the priest sexual abuse scandal. Good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just thinking, I have friends who have children in Catholic schools and that, and could there be something done to maybe give some assurance to those parents who currently have children there that, you know, that they're safe? You know, not a religious type thing, but maybe an audit that they could have some comfort to say, you know, the diocese has done a thorough investigation of everyone associated with the school or other activities
right.
and kind of got a clean bill of health.
Right. Annette, what do you make of that idea, Annette?
We can't. We don't feel that we can trust the church to church itself. They failed in that.
We have to have outside authorities.
Absolutely.
What you're suggesting,
yes.
Dennis. Yeah.
Yeah. The caller brings up a very good point, and this is something that we have called for a number of times over the last couple of years, and that is the bishops have mandated an audit of diocesan structures to make sure that the procedures that they have implemented are in place and being active at the diocesan level. But
that the rules are being followed.
That the rules are being followed, yes.
Yeah.
And that's going okay, but the National Review Board that oversees the bishops' actions nationally, the last 3 years in their annual reports to the bishops, they have suggested that kind of auditing also happen at the parish level across the country to make sure that the policies that are supposed to be happening at the parish level are being followed properly. And that has not been implemented. That's one of the things that we are pushing for, as the caller says, so the parish knows that the rules that are supposed to be in place are in place.
You know, it's almost incredulous to me that those steps aren't being taken again, Dennis, in the wake of everything we're seeing here. You think at this point, every rock would be flipped over and every step would be being taken to ensure that this stops and stops now.
Yeah,
I'd actually like to speak to that.
Yeah.
The National Review Board has recommended the parish audits, and it has become a recommendation from them, and it has actually been followed by many places. It's something that we do currently.
Even here locally in this diocese.
Locally. The auditors from the USCCB come in to do an on-site audit.
What's that acronym stand for?
Oh, I'm sorry. The United States Conference of Catholic Bishops.
Okay.
So there are auditors that come in on-site once every 3 years to a diocese to review their processes.
Does that smack carry of the church investigating itself, though?
That's an independent auditing firm that comes in that's hired by the USCCB.
Yeah. Does that satisfy you, Annette, as you look at this?
No, not at all.
Yeah, because the same thing we've talked about.
Yes, they're policing themselves still.
Yeah, okay.
And the audits are voluntary. The parish audits are recommended, but they're voluntary.
Yeah.
And the diocesan audits happen on a rotating basis.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not an annual thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all based on self-reporting.
Dennis, has the National Catholic Reporter taken a position on what it thinks should happen next year, to follow up the report out of Pennsylvania? What's the newspaper's sense of where things need to go?
The first thing that we have called for is that mechanisms are put in place to ensure that any investigation that happens is totally independent.
Mm-hmm.
And one way to ensure that is to guarantee that there's significant lay participation in what's happening, so that the bishops cannot be running this themselves.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be run outside of their offices in an independent way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's our first recommendation.
Yeah.
And this is something, the bishops are meeting, their executive committee is meeting in September to discuss this, and they're supposed to devote a portion of their annual November meeting to this issue specifically. And so we're going to be watching that really closely and making these recommendations more strongly as we go forward.
What about this call from the Star Editorial Board? And again, I should point out, I'm a member of that board, that suggests that the attorneys general in Kansas and Missouri should launch investigations here. Have you weighed in on that yet?
We haven't. We're assessing where that is and where other states are with that. And I think, Steve, tell me for sure, Jean Peters Baker, she's not all totally in favor of that. She thinks she's got a pretty good handle on the diocese.
I think
she's
indicated as much. Yeah.
Yeah.
Annette, what do you want to see happen here? What's the next step forward for the church in the wake of Pennsylvania?
They need to accept accountability, which they have failed to do. They need to stop fighting these victims. Catholics need to come together in support of these victims,
mm-hmm.
who are doing this to protect other children.
How would you feel about an investigation by the attorneys general?
Absolutely is what we need.
Mm-hmm. More investigation even by the Jackson County prosecutor, perhaps.
Yes.
Whatever form it takes, you'd be in favor of.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Let me go back to some calls here. Let's go to Nell from Overland Park. Nell, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hi there. I am so distressed over the Catholic body, the parishioners not having gotten on this 20 years ago, and just, you know, like any other business, saying, fix this and fix it now or we're taking our dollars somewhere else. Because this has been known, it's not a secret, and it's been part of, you know, the workings of the church since almost the beginning. And the Catholics have not said enough and fix it now is very distressing to me. And this last thing is, on any of these public investigations, I don't think Catholics should be on any of those panels at all to do any investigating, because they have not proven themselves as a group to be active in putting an end to this once and for all. In any church, in any religion, it has to be done, and it has to be right now. And the Catholics have to either say, I'm taking my buck somewhere else.
Right.
Or you fix it now, not yesterday.
Yes.
I mean,
I got you, Diane. I'm going to have to scoot down, but I appreciate your comments. And maybe that leads to the obvious next question here is, why is it? Why can't the church get its arms around this crisis and put it to bed for good? Again, as our callers are pointing out, this has been going on for years, and yet you still don't see the types of calls for wholesale change that you might expect for a problem of this magnitude. Dennis, what's your perspective on that? Why can't the church get its arms around it?
You know, part of it is because of the understanding of how clergy function within the Catholic Church. And to put it in a kind of a vernacular way, that they are a priest, a bishop especially, is put on a pedestal. And they are entrusted with our faith and entrusted to guide us. And that's ingrained in Catholics from a very early age. And that has been the historical way that we have looked at these people. Unfortunately, what that does, though, it breeds within that culture a clericalism that ends up protecting itself and puts itself in opposition to the larger church.
Yeah.
And so what we have been calling for is for lay Catholics to really claim the ownership of the church, and for bishops needing to step aside to be servant leaders rather than autocrats.
Kerry Cooper, again, you're with the Kansas City St. Joseph Diocese Office of Child and Youth Protection. What's your sense of why the church hasn't been able to get its arms around this crisis and end it for good?
I agree with some of what Dennis was saying. With, you know, priests and bishops are our moral authority, but there's a place for lay people in the church to bring in the expertise to deal with these issues. And that's something that the church is trying to do. We're educating our children in our Catholic schools. There was a caller earlier that mentioned, you know, how do I know my kids are safe? We're educating kids to understand safe boundaries and to know, to notice signs of grooming so that they can say no, so that they have a voice. And I think those prevention efforts are really, really important. That's being done by lay people, by teachers, for all the children in our programs. Adults are being trained to recognize the signs of abuse. All the adults, the Catholic, the lay people, and the priest can come together knowing, having this information, and be better able to be a stronger safety net of protection for kids going forward.
Well, why aren't we hearing calls to change some fundamental aspects of the church, allowing married priests, for instance, allowing women priests, and moving away from a model of single men serving as the leader of parishes across the country when this problem is as rampant as it is?
Part of that is that we were just talking about this at the office where I came over. There's no direct connection as such between celibacy and child abuse. You know, there's no direct connection between if you have a married clergy, are the problems going to be solved? And so
I may be getting out over my skis here, though, Dennis. I mean, this problem seems to be far more rampant and apparent in this church as opposed to other churches, that, you know, the Episcopal Church, for instance, you know, the Methodist Church, other mainline churches. And again, maybe I'm wrong, but I haven't seen reporting that would suggest the problems are equal there.
I think, but if you look at like the Mormon Church, and if you look at Jehovah's Witnesses, they have equal kinds of problems with this. And what I think those churches have in common is that very high regard for the clergy and lack of transparency, lack of sunshine into how church decisions and processes and administrations happens.
Well,
I think that's the larger connection that we need to be paying attention
Carrie,
to.
Carrie, yeah.
Well, in any institution where there's an imbalance of power and there's someone that is vulnerable, there's an opportunity for abuse. And we've seen this in the gymnastics, the U.S. gymnastics. We've seen this in
higher education, sure.
In lots of different institutions.
Yeah.
So part of the issue, I think we talked about it earlier within the Catholic Church, was the lack of transparency
right.
that Annette called for and that we mentioned earlier. So that's something that can be improved. But I don't know that abuse is necessarily more rampant in the Catholic faith than it is in any other institution.
Annette, I'll give you the last word here, then I got to wrap this up.
Steve, what we would like to see is with Catholics, lay people, instead of them donating to the Catholic Church and funding these bishops who have hidden this abuse, we would like to see them donate money to abuse programs that help children, is what we would like, to protect them.
Okay, we're going to leave our conversation there about the struggles of the Roman Catholic Church right now. Dennis Cody with the National Catholic Reporter was here. Carrie Cooper, Director of the Diocesan Office of Child and Youth Protection. Annette Hodges with SNAP. Thank you all for a good conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having us today.
Thanks a lot, Steve.
Time for a break. When we come back, how to talk to each other across the big political divide in this country. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday in the show, we talked with two great young people from the Kansas City Muslim Civic Initiative who are working to get their community more engaged politically. You can listen to these new voices at kcur.org/uptodate. Well, we are still a nation divided. No one disputes that these days. But we still need to talk to each other, don't we? At least that's the theory. But these days, reaching across the social and political divide is not only difficult, it's downright treacherous, even dangerous. Justin Lee has written a new book aimed at helping Americans navigate the yawning divide. The book, Talking Across the Divide, How to Communicate with People You Disagree With and Maybe Even Change the World. Justin Lee has spent more than 20 years helping people build bridges between conservative and progressives on matters of faith and public policy. He's also the author of Torn, Rescuing the Gospel from the Gays versus Christians Debate. Justin, it's nice to have you. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
You know, a lot of people are just giving up. At least that's my sense out there. They don't think there's any way to bridge this huge chasm that separates Republicans from Democrats, abortion rights people from anti-abortionists. Why are you so convinced there's hope out there, Justin?
Well, I've seen it happen. I've seen these bridges be built and I've seen them work. It's not easy, but I've spent, as you said, 20 years doing this work. Particularly at the intersection of the LGBT conversations and the Christian church, and particularly in less affirming, more evangelical leaning or conservative leaning parts of Christianity. And, you know, a lot of people have sort of given up on that conversation. And I found that there are techniques, there are ways that we can have this conversation that actually move things forward and help change minds and change hearts where people thought that the minds and hearts couldn't be changed. So I believe it is. Well, I know it's possible. And it's just a matter of whether we're willing to do it.
What do you mean, whether we're willing to do it or not? Because everyone says they're willing to do it, but somehow it doesn't seem to be changing.
Well, I think one of the things that we're really struggling with is that on some of the issues we disagree on, I mean, some of these issues are so big and so important. We are afraid often that to dialogue with people who disagree with us is tantamount to legitimizing their point of view, that it's giving them some kind of legitimacy or platform that they didn't have, and that really if we have a strong position, that what we need to do is just shut them down and not even engage. But what's happened is we've gotten into these echo chambers, these bubbles on the left and on the right and, you know, on our side of whatever the issue is that we care about. And we don't talk to each other. We just talk to people who agree with us, and we listen to the news sources and entertainment sources and whatnot that are on our side, and we get further and further apart and just don't even know how to communicate anymore. And that's dangerous.
You know, you say in the book that one key to working with people with dramatically different viewpoints is to engage with something you call strategic dialogue. What is strategic dialogue?
Essentially, strategic dialogue is a form of dialogue, of communication across these lines that recognizes right up front that sometimes there is no middle ground. Sometimes it's not a matter of just agreeing to disagree. Sometimes you want to change somebody's mind or at least change their attitude in some way, and that there are ways to have conversation strategically that are both honest and sincere, but also smart to move the conversation forward in ways that are productive for all of us. And so that's what strategic dialogue is all about.
Let's go with that. So what do you mean exactly? How can you offer people a few tips for the next time they sit down at the family dinner that you write about in the book so well, you know, that when things tend to go off course pretty quickly, what can people do to begin to have more constructive conversations in settings like that?
Sure. Well, there are a lot of things. One of them that's really simple, deceptively so, is to listen. We don't spend a lot of time listening to our opponents in these conversations because we think we already understand them. We already know why they think what they think, and we want them to listen to us. But really, when we sit down and honestly listen to somebody, especially in a one-on-one setting where you get away from, you know, social media, by listening, you help to calm the other person down if they're upset, help them to feel heard and make them then more open to listening to you. But also, you can learn a lot about what is motivating them really, what's underneath the surface, what have they believed that maybe, you know, is not true, that is an issue that you need to address. So listening is one of the big things we can do. And another thing we can do is to use personal stories rather than just facts. Often, you know, we may disagree on the facts, and that's a major barrier in our conversation. And we think, well, then I just need to, you know, point to all the sources that prove that my facts are right and yours are wrong. But if they don't accept your sources as legitimate, that doesn't get you anywhere. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you share a personal story, especially an emotion-driven personal story, that can help to help the other person to empathize and help to open doors that seemed like they were shut.
How does knowing where someone's coming from, you know, what the motivation is for why they believe what they believe, how does that help the listener begin to navigate a path forward to have a constructive dialogue with that person?
Well, one of the, you know, something I've seen a lot in my conversations on LGBT issues. So I grew up in a conservative Southern Baptist home and then realized I was gay. And, you know, my family and my church were all very anti-gay, and I was too. But then here I am gay, and I'm trying to figure all that out. And one of the things I found in having these conversations is, for instance, both, you know, people on both sides may care very passionately about the kids. You know, it's like, well, you know, but what about the kids? Well, I have this position because I care about the future of our children. You know, well, that's important for me to know. If you and I are on the opposite side of an issue and both of us care about kids, that's something that I can actually use to talk about. Let's talk about what's going on with the kids. This is, you know, really what's important to you. Often people will give you an answer right up front as to what's important to them, why they believe what they believe. That's not really what's driving them emotionally. It's just sort of their intellectual kind of justification for their position. But if you can get to those underlying motivations, then you can say, oh, okay, this is what this is really about for you. Let's talk about that. Let's talk about the economics of this. Let's talk about how this affects your family or whatever it is. And that can, you know, open up the dialogue to where they're actually interested in having a conversation that's productive.
We're talking with Justin Lee about ways that folks who come from issues from completely different vantage points can actually communicate with each other. His new book, Talking Across the Divide, How to Communicate with People You Disagree With and Maybe Even Change the World. You know, is a mistake that a lot of people make in these conversations that they go into it thinking that I am, and you referred to this already, that I am going to change you know, the person's mind, they're going to come over to my way of thinking, that that original motivation is sort of a way to get things off kilter very quickly.
I think, you know, I think it's a little of both. On the one hand, I think if you say, well, you're never going to change the other person's mind, so, you know, you should just go into the conversation just trying to understand them. Well, on some issues, that may be okay. But there are other issues where, no, I really want to change this person's mind. You know, you were just having a conversation about the Catholic Church and abuse going on there. Mm-hmm. Well, there's a situation where, you know, there's not a kind of middle ground where it's like, oh, we'll just agree to disagree. No, we're talking about people's well-being on a very important issue. So there may be situations like that where it's like, no, I need to move this person. I really, it's important to me that this person change their position because it matters. On the other hand, I think often it's true that if we take an all or nothing approach, that either you come 100% to my way of thinking, or, you know, there's no worth, it's not worth talking. Well, then sometimes that means that no conversation happens, when in fact, maybe you could move the person some baby steps in the right direction and at least accomplish something, even if you don't get everything you want in, you know, in one dialogue. So I think there's a, you know, sometimes you do want to change somebody's mind, but you also have to be practical about what's realistic. How much is it realistic to expect them to change in a given period of time?
We have a tweet here from Dr. Linda, who writes us to say that I suggest to clients facing holiday discord these two sentences: tell me more about that, and or you might be right. Both are intended to move conversation versus arguing and about not being right. Does that advice make sense to you?
It absolutely does. One of the things that can stop these conversations in their tracks is that people can get very defensive if they feel like you're approaching them as an idiot or a villain. Mm-hmm. And so if you can, the kind of language that she's suggesting is, I think, wonderful language for lessening the tension and saying to somebody, actually, you know, you have something worth contributing to this conversation. I care about it. I want to know more about what's going on in your head and what you believe and what you've been through and why you care. And I'm not just approaching you as some idiot or villain who I'm just going to steamroll over. And when people feel that you actually care and are interested in what they have to say, and then you listen and you show them that you have heard what they have to say, then they become much more open to hearing what you have to say and considering that maybe they could change their mind on some things as well.
You know, another barrier out there that, again, you write about in the book, Justin, is this idea of the good old-fashioned ego. No one wants to look stupid in an argument, and that can rear its head and cause lots of problems.
That's right. You don't want to make somebody look foolish, because if they feel like they're being made to look foolish, then all their defenses come up. And so sometimes what we have to do is create a narrative that allows somebody to shift their position or shift their thinking without looking like they're just a fool and that everything that they've invested their time and energy into has been all for naught. And that can be tricky to do. But in the book, I talk about some of the ways that you can craft that kind of narrative, mm-hmm. because it's a really powerful thing when you learn how to do it.
You know, I was really interested in the book, and I wanted to get to this before our time is out. You have a friend, and again, you write about this, who successfully engaged, and folks, hang on to your seats here, with members of the Westboro Baptist Church. This is the group from Topeka. Fred Phelps was involved for so many years that made bashing gay people their trademark. How did your friend manage to engage successfully, it sounded like, with members of the church? And what did he walk away with there?
Yeah, his name is Jeff Chu.
Right.
He's an author as well. He's got a book called Does Jesus Really Love Me? Which I recommend. come on the show and promote his book. Jeff is a gay man who is a wonderful interviewer. And he did meet with the folks over at Westboro and get to know them, which, you know, I can't imagine doing. And he learned that a lot of their motivation was coming from this particular kind of extreme Calvinist theology that they had, that they're not really interested in trying to change people's minds. They just want to be heard because their theology says that they're supposed to be heard, and it doesn't matter if they're persuasive, and that's why their messages aren't persuasive. And learning that helped Jeff to then teach me a lot about how to respond to situations where Westboro may be protesting an event that I'm involved in. And a lot of it is by denying them the kind of publicity that they want. Don't buy into that, because they don't care if they're not changing your mind. They just want to get the publicity. So, it's interesting that even in those extreme situations with people who you think there's no reason to talk to this person, Jeff didn't change Westboro's mind. But by talking to them, Jeff learned about how to respond to them in a way that's, I think, much more productive than maybe I would otherwise have done.
You know, I was surprised he was even able to get in the door, that they would agree to have a dialogue with him, given how staunch, how strongly they hold these beliefs.
Yeah, and I wasn't there, but from hearing him talk about it, my sense is not that they agreed to some kind of dialogue where they thought they would learn from him, but rather, you know, he expressed an interest in understanding them, and they were willing to let him understand them. And I think people generally want to be understood. Even the people who we think of as the greatest villains in our lives, they want to be understood. And if they feel that you're interested in understanding them, that opens doors for you and gives you opportunities to accomplish things that you might not otherwise think you could accomplish.
You know, speaking of opening doors, the other technique, one other technique of several that you recommend, is tell their story back to them. You're engaged in a dialogue with someone, and at some point you pause and sort of repeat what's been said. What do you mean by that, and why is that effective?
Well, Dale Carnegie said that a person's name is the most beautiful sound to them, and I think that somebody's story is likewise. There is something about when someone can tell your story back to you in a way that paints you as the protagonist, that's really gratifying about that, because it's like, wow, this person has heard me. This person understands what I'm going through, and they understand how I see the world enough that they can explain my point of view in their own language. People don't do that very often. And it's one of the reasons I think that, you know, therapy can be really helpful. If you have a good therapist who can do that and can say, what I hear you saying is da 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 da, and they can say it well, that's like, it's incredible. And so again, that's something that helps people feel like, wow, you really get me. So you must have then something to say that's worth me listening to.
And inherent in all of this is this idea that people maybe just need to slow down a little bit in these conversations.
Yeah, I think so. I think ultimately we can have strong positions on issues and believe that people are absolutely wrong and that it matters, but we can do it without an us versus them mentality that pulls us further apart, because that's counterproductive. We need a way to talk to each other and still be able to move conversations forward in a helpful way, so that we can continue to live together in this world and accomplish good things that require both sides to work together to make them happen.
Justin Lee is the author of Talking Across the Divide, How to Communicate with People You Disagree With and Maybe Even Change the World. Justin, thanks for a good conversation. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you so much. And your listeners can find me online at geekyjustin.com, because I'm a big old geek.
Sounds good. Thanks very much. Yesterday in the show, we took a trip down memory lane and talked about beloved children's movies. To hear what films the cinephiles mentioned, you should revisit with your kids. Head to kcur.org/up-to-date. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Kathleen Pointer. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.